The following message was recorded at the 2011 No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. And now, our featured presentation.
Got your swords? Take your Bible and turn, if you would, to the book of 1 Samuel. Thank you, David. Put my water on that stool, and then when my back goes out, I'll sit down. I got one too many parachute wrecks and one too many car wrecks, and the old back doesn't like to stand up all day anymore. We're talking about warfare. We're talking about living on a planet that's a war zone. We spent some time this morning looking at the big picture of what needs to go into the soul of the warrior, that transcendent cause, that it's not about us. We're living and dying for the King, whose kingdom is eternal. We learned that in order to do that, we've got to have this settled memory about the things the Lord has spoken and about the stakes that He has driven in our lives so that we don't forget who we are. As the old proverb says, if you dwell on the past, you lose an eye. If you forget the past, you lose both eyes. So we've got a settled memory. We've got a personal intensity. We recognize that we are focused and fully following, and that's it. And we develop this unflagging optimism because we serve the King of Kings, and we see all things, even the things that feel bad, as part of God's grace to us to move us closer to Him. We have this great optimism, and then we have a deep camaraderie. That's what I want to work on with you this afternoon. It's part of my personal story, part of my personal life, part of the redemption of the King in my life, part of my learning to dwell in the shadow of His wings, as Jaden was singing. I want to work with you on that because it's important in this battle that we're in, so that if we do get hit, we got somebody with us big enough to carry us. Of course, Jesus is the best friend in all of the world and will carry us through anything. But in His genius, He gave us three change agents for our lives. He gave us His Word, which teaches us. He gave us His Spirit, who guides us. And He gave us His people as companions in the battle. And I don't know how it is for you, but I find that when I'm in the middle of the battle, when I am in pain, when I have lost perspective, when things aren't going as I'm expecting them, I don't always read the Bible the same way. Am I the only one that does that? It feels like words on a page sometimes, and I'm not meeting my Lord like I want to because of what's in me. And I know from Scripture that I have the power to quench the Spirit of God. But here's what I found in my life. When I'm in pain and when I've lost perspective and when I'm discouraged, when I am discontented, when I'm in the cave of Adullam with David, I can't get away from my friends. They won't let me go down in the battle. They will carry me when I'm being hit. And that's what I want to talk with you today about. I have in my Bible a list of names who are friends of mine whom I still love dearly, but I don't see very often anymore. They were seminary classmates. They were more highly committed than your average Christian, if I could put it that way. These are guys that were giving their lives to vocational ministry and took 3 or 4 years out of their lives after college to go to graduate school to learn God's word so they could be the soldiers that they were intended to be. And every one of them has fallen. Some through adultery, some through financial embezzlement. Who knows what others have fallen from? But they're not in the ministry anymore. And every one of them, common trait, they were isolated in their souls. They didn't have a battle buddy. They didn't have another man, soul to soul, that can understand manhood and all that it faces and could pull them back from the precipice when they walked up close to it. The story of my life is involved in some of those kinds of friendships. I honestly believe I would not be qualified for ministry today if it weren't for 4 or 5 intimately close man friends who know my soul, my marriage, my family, my life, and they hold me in the battle. They carry me when I get hit. That's the way God intended us to live our lives, not in isolation. Isolation is a cruel and unusual punishment. He created us in His image. He made us for relationships. And when you think about it, our God is the first small group. Father, Son, and Spirit, He never goes anywhere without His 2 best friends. They're always together in the battle. So who are we to think that we don't need that? Well, we're sinful men and we're prideful men, and we don't want people inside there because there are weaknesses and vulnerabilities and some wrong things in there, and it hurts. We want to work on that a little bit today. Paul says, our struggle isn't against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and powers and principalities, world forces of darkness, against spiritual forces of wickedness. These are supernatural powers. And as my old buddy Farrar says, he, the adversary, studies our game films. And he knows our habits. And he knows our vulnerabilities. And at just the right point, he puts the knife in to take us out of the battle. But the way you fight this war, the way you reinforce those qualities of the warrior's soul, is in the company of other men who are after the same goal. If you want to be a great ball player, you got to play ball with great ball players. If you want to be a great shooter, you got to have some good shooting coaches. If you want to be a great Christian man, you got to run with some great Christian men. That's the way it is in God's good word. So we're going to work on that a little bit. If God never goes anywhere without his two best friends, how about you and me? There is a synergy in that kind of powerful masculine friendship. You see it even in nature. God has so woven his wonderfully triune self into nature that you see it. You know those geese that we see flying all the time? They fly in formation for a reason. The biologists tell us they increase their range some 71% over what they could do flying alone. Because the one takes the point. When he tires, he drops to the back of the formation. The next one takes the point, and they increase their ability to fly 71%. Those big draft horses can pull so much alone. You put them together, and what they can pull increases exponentially. There is strength in togetherness. Stay together, as Maximus said, and survive. And in the Bible, I think it's stay together and thrive. We think of Paul as that solitary missionary that walked over the face of the globe and changed the whole world. But if you read the New Testament carefully, you recognize he was never alone. Never alone. If it wasn't Paul and Silas, it was Paul and Timothy, or Aquila and Priscilla, or Epaphroditus, or Epaphras. He was always with. He was the one who wrote the great passage on spiritual warfare about taking up the full armor of God. And he said to add to these all the shield of faith. And the word he used for shield is the word for the shield that the Roman legions used in formation. It wasn't the little circular shield that was the personal shield. It was the shield that actually interlocked and the formation moved together. That's the way you defend yourself in this war. The problem is we men are not very good at making friendships, are we? At least the deep interpersonal kind. Am I right? Listen to this. This is from David Smith. Men find it hard to accept that they need the fellowship of other men. The simple request, hey, let's have lunch together, is likely to be followed with the response, sure, what's up? The message is clear. The independent man doesn't need the company of another man. In fact, the image of the independent man is that he has few, if any, emotional needs. Therefore, men must manufacture non-emotional reasons for being together. A business deal must be discussed, or a game must be played, or men often use drinking as an excuse to gather together. Rarely do men plan a meeting together simply because they have a need to enjoy one another's company. Even when men frequently are together, their social interaction usually begins and remains at a superficial level. Just how long can conversations about politics and sports be nourishing to the human spirit? The same male employees can have lunch together for years and years and still limit their conversations to sports and weather and politics. They don't know how to fellowship. That's the issue. And we want to learn how to fellowship. We want to learn how to go deep. So what I want to do is walk through a friendship that I think is a model friendship in the Scripture. We'll do it relatively quickly, and then we'll wrap up with four little points that will help us take it from here and begin to practice it where we are. 1 Samuel, let's go to chapter 14, actually the end of 13. Here's a young man who is a strong young man. He understands the nature of God's kingdom. He wants to be a warrior in God's kingdom, and he's living in a very dark, discouraging time. His name is Jonathan. Look at verse 19. Israel has been conquered. The Philistines have removed her capacity for warfare. No blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. They didn't have weapons. They had agricultural tools. This is Braveheart about 2,200 years before Braveheart. Okay? And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes to fix the hose. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were with Saul and Jonathan. The Philistines let the king and his son have a sword apiece, and that was it. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash to run over the top of Israel again. Now drop down to chapter 14, verse 1. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, that was his battle buddy at that point, come, let's cross over to the Philistines' garrison that's yonder side. He didn't tell his dad. Look at verse 4. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistines' garrison, a sharp crag on one side, a sharp crag on the other, Bozez, Sina, the one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash and the other on the south opposite Geba. Maybe there's some ranger tension climbing here as they're getting up there. Then Jonathan said, verse 6, to the young man who was carrying his armor, come, let's cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord... Where have you heard that before? I love that unflagging optimism of the warrior. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord isn't restrained to save by many or a few. And his armor bearer says, here I am with you. Follow your desire. And then verse 13, Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, some major tension climbing, with his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, put some to death after him. And that first slaughter with Jonathan, his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within about a half a furrow and an acre of land, and there was trembling in the Philistine camp. I point out, this is a very strong man. This is a very strong warrior. And he longs in his heart, I believe, for a friend. So a little bit later, flip over in 1 Samuel, and you see this man, young man after God's own heart, coming to the Valley of Elah, where the Philistines are still after the Israelites. And you know the story in chapter 17 of what David does to that giant. Now, when you define warrior in Scripture, it's always the man of the in-between. Philistines, Israel, the Valley of Elah between, and the giant of the Philistines would come down to the in-between to face off with the champion of Israel who would not come down. So David came down to be the man of the in-between. And the biblical warrior is the man who stands between all that he loves and holds dear and all that would harm them. So David becomes the man of the in-between. I believe that's one of the reasons that the Lord loves to open the New Testament with the words, this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus the Christ, the son of David. Because that's what Jesus came to do. He was a warrior who climbed to the high ground of Calvary. He shed his blood. He took the blows. He took the best the enemy had to offer. And he gave his life for his people who were near and dear to him. The warrior is the man of the in-between. So David now has been the man of the in-between in chapter 17. And look at the end of chapter 17 at verse 55. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose kid is that? And Abner said, well, by your life, king, I don't know. And the king said, well, find out. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. They never told us that part in Sunday school, did they? And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I'm the son of your servant, Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Now it came about when he'd finished this after-action report to the king that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. I believe Jonathan was looking for a friend. And he may have not known David much before that time, but there was something that happened in what he saw that drew him to David, and the two of them became fast friends. Such fast friends that they actually discussed the quality of their friendship. Intensely loyal. When Jonathan's father was bad-mouthing David, Jonathan got up from the table and walked off. That's my friend. I'm loyal to him. And then David had to flee, chapter 20. We're kind of walking quickly through his life. And the time came in chapter 20 at the end, or just before verse 4, at the second part of verse 3, David says to his friend Jonathan, whose soul is knit to his, truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's hardly a step between me and death. I'm about to die. And look at the response of his friend. Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. Don't you wish you had a friend like that? The kind Patrick Morley says you could call at 3 o'clock in the morning. He says most of us could scrape up a few guys to be honorary pallbearers at our funeral. But how many of us know who we're calling at 3 o'clock and know that they'll be there in 20 minutes? which is the time from their location to yours. That's the kind of friend these guys were. They talk in verse 8 there about, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. You and me, we have made a covenant. We have spelled out the nature of our friendship. This is what I need. This is what you need. This is what I expect. This is what you expect. This is how we govern our friendship. And here's the purpose of our friendship. It's the transcendent cause. You see? And we'll do this together. So they go out into the field, and they're having a conversation. Verse 14, he says, if I'm still alive, would you show me the loving kindness of the Lord? Would you embody to me the loyal love of God in my life? Would you be the extension of his wings, if you will, under which I could dwell? Could we be close like that? Verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. Now it's our families and our friends. May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. And they come time to say goodbye down at the end of chapter 20. And they hugged each other and kissed each other and wept together, but David the more. And Jonathan says, I will be with you. The greatest promise in all of Scripture, the one our Savior gives to us constantly. David wanders off into the cave of Adullam, chapter 22, and it's dark and discouraging and depressing and disappointing and all the D words you can think of. His life is down. And in chapter 23, David became more aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph, 23:15. In verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh at 3 o'clock in the morning and strengthened his hand in God. And he said, I will be next to you. That's the kind of friend we need. I put this little poem in my Bible. Friendship cheers the faint and weary and makes the timid spirit brave. It warns the erring. It lights the dreary. It smooths the passage to the grave. Friendship, pure, unselfish. Friendship, man to man, all through life's allotted span, nurtures and strengthens and widens and lengthens man's relationship with man. Well, you know how things went for David, and you know how things went for Jonathan. Look over at 2 Samuel chapter 1 as we kind of trace this friendship. These guys are close. Now they're separated geographically for a time, and Jonathan with his brothers and his father meets the Philistines on the slopes of Gilboa, and Jonathan and his brothers and his father are killed. Jonathan dies. David loses his friend. I honestly believe if Jonathan had lived, there would have been no Bathsheba episode in David's life, because he knew his heart, he knew his soul, and he would have said, you know, David, the last three times we were at the club working out, you've mentioned the same girl. What's happening in your heart? But Jonathan wasn't there, and David was not quite the same ever again. In fact, he writes a poem. Look at verse 17 of 2 Samuel 1. David chanted with his lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told his people to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Look at verse 21. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty was defiled. Look at verse 22, halfway. The bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Verse 25, how have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places, Gilboa, and I am distressed for you, my brother, Jonathan. You have been very pleasing to me. Your love, your loyal love, the love of God to me was more full of wonder than even the love of woman. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? I wrote in the margin of my Bible, the language of friendship is not words, but meanings. It is an intelligence above language. I don't know where I got that from, but it's a great statement. Because a friend is one who knows you as you are. He understands where you've been, he accepts who you've become, and he still invites you to grow. I love that. I have four or five friends like that who know me as I am with all of my faults and the holes in my armor. And they understand where I've come from. They accept who I've become, and they still say, come on, let's grow together. It's very close to me. And I pray it will become so for you. When my oldest son was going off to college, he'd always wanted some friends in high school. He was envious of his younger brother, who's the same friends, studied together and played ball together and went to youth group together. And so they grew spiritually and they studied academically and they played ball and their lives were intertwined. And Kent, he had two of the three, but he never had the three. He never had that brother that walked with him in Jesus to play ball and to work academically. But when he got to college, he called me up the first week or two of college, and he said, "Dad," which is his way of saying, "I'm really glad you answered the phone because I want to tell you something. Dad, I found him. I found him. I got friends who are great athletes, who are serious about their academics, and who love Jesus with all their heart. And I'll never be the same again." And then he said, you know, he was 18. He said, "They're just studs for God." We didn't do a word study, but you know what he meant. "I'm running with champions, and it's so good for my soul." Well, they developed a little accountability group, and they laid out the terms of their friendship like a covenant. And they said, "We're going to see to it that this is true, and this is true, and this is true, and this is true in our lives." And they became very close. And one of them wrote a poem. And I don't know if this was written to Kent or if to the whole group, but listen to this. This is 19-year-old young men who are getting things that some of us older ones didn't get. It's a poem written as though it were Jonathan writing to David the night before he died on Gilboa. "The blood on this earth brings age with it. Our young swords are crazy and giddy, and we, laughing and irresponsible, have grown old before our time. I lay all night by the singing Jordan River. My sword arm withered beneath me. My ears were pressed hard to the earth, and I thought, perhaps it was a dream, but I thought I heard you singing our praises to Yahweh. Seasons ago, when we were green, we would laugh and weep in the same breath, and we slew the enemy with God's strength in our right arms, and we ate the forbidden bread, do you remember, when we hungered? My brother, you were, and so you shall remain. I swear by my bow. And when the bow is broken, the oath shall remain. I swear by the dust of my bones, you're my lord and my brother. For the light is beginning to sing in the east, and the buckling armor shines now across the field of battle, like my longing to stand with you forever. And across the field, an enemy comes. I go, singing your songs to Yahweh. May Yahweh bind you in my heart." How 19-year-olds come up with that kind of sentiment at that age, I don't know. But they do understand this. When you're going into battle, you never, ever go alone. So I want to look at that friendship in the next bit of time we've got together and kind of characterize what I see as the power of a masculine friendship and the elements in it. Four of them. I can remember four things. Maybe you can too. And it comes out of the verse that's been the theme of No Regrets for 17 years. Proverbs 27:17. You know it. What is it? As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. So I found myself thinking about that one day. How does iron sharpen iron? I have a brother-in-law who is really good at sharpening blades, and I watch him. He's very good. When iron sharpens iron, it takes some force, in this case my brother-in-law's hands, to hold those two pieces of steel together, the blade and the steel. So that great force, that force that keeps them together and won't let them come apart, so they continue to sharpen each other, in terms of our masculine friendship, I call that the power of acceptance. Every friendship you have has to bask in the power of acceptance. Accept one another as Christ has accepted you, he says. Well, how has he accepted us? Unconditionally, without limitation, I will die for you. That's the power of acceptance. And when you experience that kind of power, you experience something strong. We had three sons. We had, as Linda says, more than our share of testosterone in the home. And she would get so frustrated at times. She was convinced we were raising delinquents. I convinced her they were just boys. It all worked out. But those boys, they could scrape on each other. They could irritate each other. But I'll tell you, when it came to pushing on one or the other from the outside, they were brothers. They're brothers. And the stuff that would normally come between them that would irritate them didn't apply anymore because they're brothers. You remember Boys Town, USA? "He ain't heavy. He's my brother. Ma'am, I'm carrying him out of that storm that's chasing us because he wouldn't make it if I wasn't carrying him, so I'm carrying him. And I just, when it comes to him, I don't even believe in the law of gravity." He ain't heavy. He's my brother. That's what we're talking about. The power that overcomes what would normally separate you as friends has no power over you because of the power of acceptance. One time, Blaker, my middle boy, was in sophomore in high school. Sophomores, they call them that because they don't know a whole lot yet. And he was leaning into his locker, and some senior came and behind him and grabbed his shirt and spun him around and squared off and tore his shirt. And Blake was panicking. He told me later, he said, "Dad, I didn't know what to do." And the crowd was gathering, and I didn't know whether to try to talk my way out of it, which would have normally been Blake's skill, or whether I should swing first, kind of a sneak attack, or if I should just take off running. And while my little brain is just scurrying to try to figure out what to do, something fast comes from the 400 hall and comes into the 100 hall where we are, and it comes so fast it knocks a girl over, and it takes that senior and shoves him up against the locker, puts his elbow in the guy's sternum and says, "Don't fight with him, he's my brother." I didn't hear the end of the story until just a couple of years ago, and they're in their 30s. And he said after he gave him a little speech there, he decided they needed a little quiet talk. And so he grabbed him by the hair and carried him out into the courtyard, and they had a private conversation over there. That's the power of acceptance. Nobody could irritate Kent like Blake. But when it comes to a battle, I will be with you, you see. So when Blake got married, and you write your stuff in the wedding program about the guys that are standing with you, Blake wanted to write, well, he did write, "Kent, you're my big brother. And for anyone who's ever really had one, that says it all. Since the day you fought old so-and-so off my back, you've been in a place all your own." That's the power of acceptance. The power of acceptance. You're my brother. And all this normal stuff that would drive us apart, it doesn't belong to us because we're friends who've accepted each other, and by God's grace, we're going to sharpen each other. Okay? The power of acceptance. And then when you're sharpening a blade on a steel, you need something else. Eventually, you have to get to the place where you use a kind of a smoothing lubricant, a honing oil. Am I right? Use a little honing oil because there's friction in these kind of relationships from time to time. And that honing oil, in terms of a masculine friendship, I call that the smoothing lubricant of affirmation. We heard it this morning in the seminar on legacy parenting about how you need to continually be telling your children how much you love them, how much you would do anything for them, how proud you are of them. We call that affirmation. We men desperately need affirmation. Have you ever noticed? We create ways to affirm one another. In the military, here on the Class A uniforms, what do they call these? They're pieces of metal and cotton, but they're affirmation. They say, "You were there, I saw you there, and what you did, I affirm." We men desperately need affirmation. And you know something? Have you ever noticed you can't really affirm yourself? I mean, you can talk yourself in the mirror all you want to, and you're still not going to believe it. But if another man looks you in the eye and says, "Way to go, you were so on when you did that, and I want to walk beside you." The power of affirmation. I had a basketball coach when I was a kid in high school. Our sophomore year, I had got 7 rebounds one game. And he made a big deal out of it. He patted me on the seat and he said, "Way to go, Weber, 7 rebounds." Now, you and I know that's not that big a deal. But he made it a big deal. He's a coach. He knows the power of affirmation. And then he said, as we concluded our time, "I bet you next week you get 10. That's all I thought about for a week. You see? The power of affirmation. 10 rebounds. I got 12. He says, 12? Double figures, man. And it went all the way up to 23, and I wasn't even the rebounder on the team. But affirmation is so strong in a boy's heart and a man's heart that we have to have it in our relationships. And we look for things that are genuinely affirmable, and then we affirm. So we have the power of acceptance. We have the smoothant of affirmation, and then we get to the little friction that has to take place. I call that the healthy friction of accountability. We need that in our lives. We need it. We desperately need it. And it requires even more vulnerability. You don't start with accountability. You start with acceptance and affirmation and work your way to earning the privilege of accountability mutually. When accountability became a big ministry term some years ago, I thought, as lead pastor, it'd be great if all the pastors were kind of linked together in accountability groups. So we put all the names in the hats, and we drew out 3 at a time. And it never occurred to me before, but I just assumed I'd get 2 guys that were like me, and we'd have a great time. I drew the church administrator, and the pastor of counseling. Now, what do you know about those two kinds of people? The administrator is absolutely fascinated with details. I don't know one when it runs over me like a train. I don't know details. He just thrives on details. Another way of saying that is he's a nitpicker, okay? And I'm in an accountability group with the church nitpicker. And then there's the pastor of counseling ministries. And they always ask weird questions, don't they? Another way of saying that, they're really nosy. And I tell you, we were in this assigned accountability group. We just assigned. We didn't even pick these guys. And the first 5 weeks was just miserable. We didn't know what to do. We just kind of gestured and talked about weather and sports and politics. And it was the worst hour of the week. And I was trying to figure out how we could graciously cancel this program without and still save face. But then about the fifth or sixth week, one of the guys took a huge risk. Warriors do that, you know. Warriors are known for their ability to risk. They know they're not invulnerable. They know they have vulnerabilities, and they're willing to take risks. And the one guy, the pastor of counseling, opened his chest and told the other two of us about a sexual temptation he'd had on a ministry trip to Atlanta. And we kicked him out of the group so fast his head spun. Right? Right. You know that's funny because you know what happened? Our jaws went open and we said, "You too?" And it dawned on us that, you know, there is no temptation faced any of us but what is not common to all of us. And so where we have liabilities, we're all in common. And where we have victories, every gift, every good thing we have in our life is the result of God's grace. So if every liability or negative is common and every asset is grace, why do we have to hide from each other? We don't have to. We don't have to. And we began to share our hearts in that accountability group, which was forced and mandated, and it became the sweetest hour of the week. Couldn't wait for 9 o'clock on Monday morning after a busy Sunday in the church ministry because I was going to meet with my buddies and we were going to be real. And it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. I encourage you to think that way because your life will be different. So we've got the power of affirmation. We've got the power of acceptance and the smoothant of affirmation. And we've got the healthy friction of accountability. And then there is... you got to have the right edge on a blade with a steel if you're going to get the perfect edge on the blade. And I call that the right angle, the authority. Knowing when to pull the trigger of authority in the friendship. So we've got acceptance and affirmation and accountability and authority. For example, my best friend of 40 years now, I've ridden his coattails for our family vacation for all 40 of those years. He's a man who lives the American dream. He's made his life. He's done very well. He has lots of resources. And he knew that our family loved to camp and hunt and fish and things. And so he would take his horses and mules, and we would take our families up into the Eagle Cap Wilderness in the northeastern corner of Oregon, and we would enjoy a week together as families. And so we're getting the mules ready, and we're headed up this trail, and we're hiking up the trail. My family hiked because we didn't have a bunch of horses, but he packed all of our stuff. They call those things, there's another word for mules that we won't repeat in here, but they're not always in line. You know what I mean? They have minds of their own, and these guys kept slowing us down. And of course, the whole point of a vacation is to get there. You know what I mean? And they were messing with us. And so by the time we got to where the camp was, I had been out of order a couple of times. But now it's over. It's done. And the camp is set up, and the wives are in the tent over there enjoying some conversation together, and the kids are asleep in their tent, and John and I are sitting up on the granite, and we're looking across the drainage at some elk feeding down the hill. And in the middle of that peace and that bliss and that joy, my best friend turned to me. I saw fire in his eyes, and he said, "I don't ever want to hear you talk to one of your sons that way again." He pulled the trigger of authority in our friendship. Probably anybody else had said, "Well, they're my sons, so get out of my face." But I couldn't with John, because he'd accepted me and affirmed me and we held each other accountable. We knew everything about our marriages. He had the right and the responsibility to say to me what he did. And so I saluted and executed, as we used to say. I obeyed my friend because he could see me more clearly than I could see myself. He knew me as I am. He knows where I've come from. He accepts me as I am, and he still invites me to grow. That's the kind of friendship we got to have. These friendships are most valuable when it's coming at us, when we're in combat, when the bullets are flying, and when we're busy ducking, and we're down and dirty and discouraged and hurting and maybe even a little wounded. That's when these friendships really show their strength. In my early life, I used to have a temper problem. My mother tells me that when I was 4 years old, I don't remember this episode, but we'd got a new garbage can. And when you were living in a coal mining town, a new garbage can is like getting a Mercedes. And my dad told me I was supposed to keep the garbage can clean. And Eddie McLean came across the alley there with a deer head that his dad had shot in hunting season. He put that thing on my garbage can. It got blood all over it, and I told him to get it off. My mother reminds me of the story because I don't remember it. And he didn't take it off, and so I hit him on the head with a hoe. And he had to go to the hospital, had his skull cracked, and his mother said to my mom, "I know Eddie can be exasperating, but tell Stu not to use weapons." And I don't even remember that, and we're just four. And I got in junior high, and there was a guy who called my mother a name that we didn't even pronounce in our family, let alone call a woman, let alone my mother. And so I went after him. He was a little faster than I was, but I couldn't catch him. So as we ran under the tree fort where a rug had fallen out, I scooped the rug up and wrapped it up as we were running. This is how blind you are to yourself. I rolled that rug up and I swung it out there like that, and I didn't mean to catch his teeth, but I did, and he lost some teeth. And Mrs. Van Fossen said, "Tell Stu not to do that." And then I got to high school, and that high school coach that I told you about that was so affirming, I would die for that guy. And he loved a well-placed technical foul, so I became his most technical player. You know? I didn't know any other way. I was just in high school. And I'm sure there were times my dad is in the stands going just like this and trying to cover up his name tag or whatever. And I can talk about it now because it was so long ago. But then I turned my life over to the Lord after Vietnam, and I was growing and I was changing. And I hadn't lost my temper for some years. And I thought, the Spirit of God actually is alive and he's changing me. They say alcoholics shouldn't hang out in bars. And I say, if you have a temper problem, you shouldn't play church league basketball. Because it came out again. It was so discouraging, I had to quit. This time I could see myself for who I was. And I had to quit playing my favorite sport because I wasn't man enough to play it. You know what I'm saying? And it hurt. And then years went by and time went by, and I didn't lose my temper for over a decade. Things were maybe 15 years I hadn't lost my temper. And I thought, I'm finally there. And then I hit 40, 45, and my sons hit varsity-level competitive athletics in high school. And I was in a bad time in my life. And I decided those guys in the striped shirts were after my boys. And I made an absolute fool out of myself in public. This is how bad it was. And I'm not the youth pastor anymore playing church league ball. I'm now the pastor. And I had to start probably a half a dozen sermons on Sunday morning with public confessions and apologies for my idiotic behavior. That's how bad it was. But here's the good news. I mean, I was getting letters from church people, okay? And I just kind of blew most of them off because my state of mind was so far gone at that point. But then I got a note from our church administrator who had been in that accountability group with me, and he said this, "Stu, I know you, and I know you want with all of your heart to honor Jesus with your life. And I know that you know that that's not happening for you right now at those basketball games. And if you would like me to, I would be willing to go to those games with you." This is a guy, I had all sons, he had all daughters, four of them. And he was willing to go sit at a basketball game with me. And where my wife couldn't speak truth into me, because she's my wife, you know, she would say, "Well, why don't you just listen to praise tapes during the basketball games? Which only made it worse because I couldn't hear anything. So I'm still yelling. And then she said, why don't you get further back in the crowd, which made my voice go over the whole crowd instead of only half of it out there. It was terrible. But Steve came to the ball games with me, and he knew me well enough to know when the temperature was rising, and he would just put his hand on my knee, and it was like a valve that just released it out of me. And it was like I said, oh, yeah, I'm a Christian. I love Jesus. I can't act like this. And it changed my life. It saved my life. I'm not joking now. It saved my job for sure, and it probably saved my life. And I owe it to a friend who accepted me, affirmed me, held me accountable, and sat as an authority beside me at the ball games. And I came out of my depression over time. And it was a good thing. So I pray that you will have that kind of a friendship in your life. So if you want that kind of a friendship, how do you get it? May I just say, be a man and initiate? Begin by praying. All you need to develop a friend like that is need. And we've all got that, so we're all qualified there. So I would say begin praying, because God our Father does not give you stones when you ask for bread. And he knows he wants a friendship like that for you. So you begin praying. Then make a list. Three guys, we drew out a hat. Make a list. That guy that parks his car in that portion of the parking lot, I want to go there. Or the guy that always sits in the front row down here, I'm kind of drawn to him for some reason. Don't even know his name, but he's on the list as the guy that sits in the front row on the right. And begin praying specifically. And then take some initiative. Buy a couple of books. And say, hey, I bought a book for you and I got one for myself, and I'd like to invite you to lunch next week. And we'll talk about the first chapter. And if nothing happens, you got a free book and a free lunch. But if we find time for each other, maybe it'll become something together. Let's see. I shared this story with a group of fighter pilots. You know, they're a different kind of men. They swagger, you know. And they're not easy to make friends because they have to guard their chest, they think. And the fighter pilot, squadron commander, 06, full colonel, says, are you telling me that I got to become Mr. Rogers? Will you be my friend? I said, no, you don't have to do that, but if you're man enough, you might try it. Now, there it was, right there. He was off and doing it. And then he wrote me a letter later, and he said, I asked 9 guys, will you be my friend? And none of them would. And then he said, but I kept going because you're bugging me. I still see that picture in the back of my mind. And the 10th one took, and my life has not been the same. I have always known the value and the love for my wingman. Now I have one in my spirit and my soul. What a good thing. So I pray that for you. I pray that you will have the courage to go find that third essential. You love the Bible, you obey the Spirit of God, and you walk with his people, especially a few man friends that can own your soul with you. And watch you win battle after battle after battle. It is so good, so very good. I have this vision. I want to hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant, someday, don't you? I mean, I want to hear that really badly. But I know this soul, I know this heart, I know how dark it is. And I'm not sure. You know what I'm saying? But I have this vision of standing before the Lord one day in the Bema seat, and you and I, we're all in line. There's a big long line of guys down there, and I'm coming up to the front. And I hear well done when it's just me and him. Well done, Stu. And I get emotional in my vision of this. And then I find a phrase coming out of my lips that points to the guy standing beside me in line. It's a phrase that I borrow from a letter that was at the Vietnam Wall in D.C. It means so much to me, I put it in my Bible. It was a fellow who, 20 years after the war, wrote a letter to his friend who's on the wall and laid it at the foot. And this is what it reads. John, the things I'm going to say in this letter are about 20 years and a whole lifetime late, but maybe that won't matter once they've been said. We trusted each other, you and me. Heard that phrase before, haven't we? We trusted each other, you and me, implicitly, totally. We depended on each other. We supported each other. We shared a whole lot in the time that we knew each other. Pain and hunger and sickness and triumph and laughter and more than a little excitement. We even shared a lover. Death was her name. Both of us wooed her, but you won her. What a deal for you. You know, I've never forgiven you for leaving me alone. And I've been alone and lonely ever since. ... And I never thanked you for the times that you saved my life any more than you thanked me for the time that I saved yours. I think we kind of thought it was understood. See, there were young men. They didn't know how to talk about their relationship yet. But as he's aged, he's begun to realize where truth and reality lies in his own chest. I think we kind of thought it was understood and didn't matter that it be expressed. But it seems to mean something now. It's really important to say it. Thank you, John. A lot of the guys who were there in Vietnam say they feel like they lost something in country. I know what I lost. I've always said that when you died, it was like the other half of myself. I lost my youth and all of the idealism and trust and self-confidence and personal power that we had either inside of us or drilled into us. And I'm scared now, John, most of the time. And I hurt a whole lot. What happened to us cost me a life as much as it cost you yours. And I never got to say goodbye. So I've come to this monument to have a little memorial service and to say goodbye and to let you go. I will never forget you. Don't you worry about that. And then this line. I am a living testimony that you were good at what we did together. I find myself standing before my Lord and hearing, well done. And I'm so overcome, all I can say is, well, Lord, I'm a living testimony that Steve and John and Jim were good at what we did together. We will stand together. I love the thought of that well done. And I'm going to have my arms around my buddies when I hear it. And I would like that for you too. You pray that way. And when we come to the prayer of commitment now, you think about these kinds of things, that it might be the one who carries you when you get hit. God bless you, and thank you for letting me be with you today. It's been a delight. Thank you.